This is Noisy People. I'm Tim Perkis. Today my guest is the German turntablist, saxophonist, and improviser, Ignaz Schick. This is an untitled track from the 2005 CD from Perlinix with Ignaz Schick, Jörg Maria Zager, and Burkhard Bynes. Experimental music is an international phenomenon, and it has its handful of influential capitals, centers of concentrated activity. We in the Bay Area like to think that San Francisco is one of these spots, which may be our own myopia, but anyone who is at all conscious of this music would acknowledge that Berlin is definitely a major center. By the mid-1990s, a young generation of artists, including musical improvisers, were streaming to Berlin from all over Europe, drawn by its cheap cost of living and sense of wild open possibility after the fall of the wall in 1989. Frustrated with the conventions of the existing and at that time dominant European free jazz scene, they invented a whole new unofficial and initially unfunded scene, playing in empty warehouses, cafes, nightclubs, and punk squats. They stood all the conventions of free jazz on their head, where free jazz was often busy, loud, macho, hyper-expressive, and usually played on traditional jazz instruments, sounding like this. They invented a music that, while still retaining the spirit of improvisation and live immediacy, was cool, quiet, and full of silences and electroacoustic sounds, also incorporating what might be seen as more feminine sensibilities. The scene came to be known as the Berlin New Wave, or the participants' chosen name, Echtzeitmusik, real-time music. In an analogy with typography, some of the work of this eclectic scene was called lowercase music, indicating a music that doesn't shout in all caps. My guest Ignaz Schick was a major factor in defining this scene, playing with most of its luminaries, producing concerts and festivals, engaging in the theoretic conversation which often accompanies European art movements, and in exporting awareness of it by touring extensively throughout Europe, Asia, and the Americas. We began our conversation with the story of how he, as a child of back-to-the-land radicals in rural Bavaria, became obsessed with new music through a chance encounter with the legendary free jazz trumpeter and Ornette Coleman collaborator Don Cherry.
I was raised in a very rural area called Lower Bavaria in the southeastern area of Germany. I grew up there as a kid in the late 70s, early 80s. It was still the Cold War time, so it was a bit isolated because it was close to the Czech border. I was basically raised on a small farm, one of the first German or Bavarian organic farms my parents had started in the 70s. It was enough to sustain the family, so it was kind of alternative. In a way, it was very culturally, I grew up relatively isolated. I mean, there was, in our family, there was no music. There was a very good friend of the family who was living close, and he was into jazz. This friend of the family, he took me there was a weekend free jazz festival announced in Austria in the central mountains south of Salzburg.
So you're like a little kid.
Yeah, I was like between 11 and 12, almost 12, 11 years old, and I had no idea actually what I was going into. I was just like very curious and went into this like main tent. I realized there's a lot of interesting people at this like backstage area, and I sneaked in. I got very much into that and started basically dancing on stage. That got me a bit of in trouble, like the organizers were not so happy about it, and then there was this like super friendly skinny black dude starting to dance, and we were like having a good time dancing, and like reminding me in a bit of this like alternative community figures in a way. And I had no idea who that was, basically. It was just like...
Who was it?
It was Don Cherry, who I had never heard about it, of course.
It was like the trumpet player.
Free jazz
trumpet player.
Iconic musician already at that time, of course, a big name, and I had no idea, and that got me immediately out of trouble.
That was sort of like the beginning of a friendship with him that extended, I mean, it was a very until exactly, his death really
yeah,
over
yeah, exactly.
like 20 years later.
Yeah, well, not even, it was 84 I met him, and he died 95, so it was about 10 years.
So how did that translate into what you did later? And
like Don just told me, like, yeah, excuse me, I have to work a little bit, but you can stay right here at stage and enjoy it from here. And he pulls out this like small pocket trumpet he was famous for, and I remember like the first note, it changed my life. I was like, wow, what is this guy doing? This is amazing. I mean, it's completely changed the whole, like, it was clear from the first, like, after the first notes I heard from him, this is what I want to do in my life. I want to become one of those guys. Something in the sound, I mean, it had such a humanity and warmth and joy. And as a kid, I always felt isolated in school, being a stranger, being from this like strange farm. So when I met those guys, I realized, okay, there's more people out there with a really strong alternative thinking about things. And I didn't need to behave different. I could be myself. Like, this is like the first thing which I felt like when I met Don, and it's like, just be yourself. Don knew everybody. I mean, he introduced me to everybody. And so I got back home, and this friend had a huge record collection, and I started really like dubbing all the tapes and the records on tapes, and getting really straight into hardcore avant-garde free jazz, like from...
So you're going from sort of almost no musical background at all to right into like free jazz.
Right into free jazz, exactly. Yeah. And from there, I mean, it's a pretty extreme choice for an 11-year-old. But I mean, basically Albert Eiler, Sonny Rollins, Coltrane, Ornette, a lot of Ornette.
So all through your teenage, you were still living there with your parents.
Yeah.
And you would have this regular exposure to this music.
Waiting basically for this festival, and then also trying. I mean, there was
starting to play yourself at a certain point.
Immediately, yeah. I mean,
immediately.
I mean, it was
you got a saxophone.
The saxophone took a few months, but it was a bit like it took my parents a bit of time to save the money. As a kid, I always wanted to be a farmer, but then when this like the music thing came on, and they realized, okay, this is not just a kind of child fashion. But it was not easy, because still, like, jazz, the main education for me was like learning by doing. Whenever Don Cherry would come into the somewhere close to the area, I would make sure I would be able to get there. I mean, the main thing was like to listen, like learn how to listen and to find your own voice. I mean, that was the base. And then don't worry about what people are saying. Do your own thing. But you need to also work on this and this and this and this, and
yeah,
and and then he would ask to, like, when I had my horn with me, like, he would ask me to sit in, which was like the first time it happened. I was really scared, but it was a very important experience also to realize what amazing amount of joy those guys, a lot of joy and fun they had playing with each other and experiencing that. There was like, it was really about music making and not about so much what I don't in the European music education system is so much about fear and scaring people not to make mistakes, and that was a whole different way, a very different way of approach of doing things.
Ignaz Schick, saxophone, Clayton Thomas, bass, and Paul Lovens, drums, live in Zoglau. Thank you. So locally, I mean, where you were living,
that was enough.
You weren't finding anybody to play with. So I mean, you got into doing electronic music as an alternative that you could do alone.
Yeah. And that kind of like also made me start to use the turntable for record players for the first time, because I would just take samples off of things which I couldn't produce myself. Yeah. Very naively, very long stretches sometimes could be clearly identified, like, and then collaging it with other stuff.
Well, it's great. You're young. You don't have any notion of copyright and all that. Exactly. You're just trying to make stuff.
Yeah. And so that was then always becoming a parallel thing. Like, I mean, I would practice for 3 hours, 4 hours until I couldn't anymore, and then maybe work for 2 hours, 3 hours on the tape machine to do something. And for me, like anything what was avant-garde, I would be interested in. Like, it for me, it didn't matter if it would be some composed Stockhausen Ligeti stuff, or then I remember like a big revelation was finding Harry Parch. Like, that was really a shock. Like, I mean, that I was very occupied with his stuff, but it was very hard to find information. So that was like pre-internet times. My partner, my girlfriend at the time, she was in Munich, so I moved there.
So this is like when you're...
Early 90s.
How old are you then?
20. I went to study at the Art Academy because I felt like from what I was having taken from the music studies in theory and technique, that it was a good ground to build on, but that I didn't... It became clear to me that I would not be the white guy from Germany competing with all these great players I had heard from New York, like... That this whole jazz thing...
So just, you didn't feel like it really, just because of where you came from, that the jazz thing was really open to you to really be a full participant in that, the free jazz thing.
Yeah, I mean, it was a generational thing more. I mean, the main decision for me to move to Berlin was this, that I remember I arrived, I was looking for a place in Germany. I was thinking about Cologne, but it was too village-like. It felt like a small town almost for me, like it was too West German for me. And Berlin had this wildness, and it suddenly, like from the whole eastern part, it was very rough at the time. And then it had suddenly, like I came there and the decision was there's...
What year is this? This is...
I moved there in 95, so okay. 5 years after the wall came down. 95, suddenly there was a young scene of my generation. So that was like, wow, finally my generation is there, because my main problem was like starting out so early. I was always surrounded by much older guys.
So there's a certain aesthetic similarity, a generational thing in common, this idea that you're kind of sampling other music. And
That came from the older guys weren't
about.
I remember there was like a concert series in a squat every Sunday where all these young players were meeting. It was a really rough, punky, kind of, yeah, funky squat back room and where every Sunday the whole scene would come. And it was easy to set up concerts. In Berlin, there was so much empty space. It was so easy to organize in abandoned houses or squats to set up concerts. And the living, of course, at that time was extremely cheap.
This is Ignatz and Andrea Belfi from their 2009 CD, The Myth of Persistence, on the Zarek label.
Reached a point where your music was, where you had a sense of what you were doing, that you were trying to differentiate yourself from this older generation. Could you describe what it is that you feel like you gained, or what is the characteristic of this?
Yeah, it was a moment where this must have been 96 in the winter. I remember I said, "Fuck, I'm done with this. I'm not interested in trying to make a classic career of." There was people who were trying to build their careers by playing with certain people who had a certain name, and I said, "No, I'm not even going to try this. Like, I want to do my real own thing." And I sat down one evening and started recording this like tape collage piece of 1 hour, and I started taking that out and performing it live.
So this is a completely different sort of format than everything that's going on.
And I took out either the tape machine or the CD player. Then I had the sampler. I started with working with the sampler.
So you would do an assemblage or kind of a mix live of this material?
Yeah, like improvising with these prepared materials, basically. Sampled, self-produced from 97 on. I played electronic concerts and said, fuck this kind of very rigid jazz, free jazz, improv scene. There was a shift from a lot of the players from the generation I'm still playing with. They all had a change of aesthetic and change of instrumentation. Suddenly, like, I started my own label, put out stuff, and so there's like, wow, there's something new going on in Berlin.
So this is this whole new aesthetic that came out of Berlin that happened simultaneously among you and your contemporaries. Yeah. I have an understanding of it, incomplete understanding of it, and hadn't realized how much it really did come out of a sort of almost reaction to a free jazz, and that it has that strong a connection with free jazz, that these are players who are still improvisers, but they're doing it in the context of this kind of electronic material or electroacoustic material.
And all of us players were trying to play in that late 80s, 90s style, trying to find their own way through that, and all of us were struggling in a way, because it was clear, I mean, this is a language developed from people from way before, and like all of us had so many different influences also, which were an important role. I mean,
they were kind of stifled in that
but
style.
It was all like
weren't represented in
that
style.
But it was a whole new world, and there wasn't real interest also in audience in Berlin. I mean, I remember when I started the festival then at this period also, I started immediately at this time also saying, it all happened in this moment, like, and then we were starting doing our own festivals, different people had a festival, people started clubs, and they were just like, okay, like, we really want to do our own thing.
So aside from just being sort of incorporating sampling and kind of electronic materials and electroacoustic kind of sound materials, there was also this kind of shift in mood of this music, and this is the thing people call lowercase and how would you describe what that shift is?
I mean, it was an idea to concentrate material in a way, like to take out all the necessary glue. I mean, to strip down the material to its essence, to I mean, there was this also idea, like, if almost like a microscope, to dive into the material. That was always my interest, to bring out the resonance of objects or to have a microscopic look on certain material. It didn't need to be necessarily silent.
The music that went before the music you're talking about, this older improvisational music, has this very kind of machismo about it, sort of, and a certain kind of a...
It had flow, it had pulse.
It had a lot of strong kind of...
It was always still...
Expressionistic.
Yeah, and it has... I mean, it was the busyness, I think, which was... Like, there would never be a silence, almost. Like a moment of a pause. Like, the element of pause in much of the 80s, 90s music did not exist.
Was there a sort of a gender change in a way that seemed like your generation was like more inclusive, more women involved in that scene, and
definitely.
The thing was sort of designed, you know?
Yeah, I mean, if I look now, I mean, definitely much higher percentage than it used to be when I appeared on the scene.
This is Ignaz and Andrea Neumann from their 2001 CD, Petit Pal. Thank you.
Could you explain what your turntable orchestra project was?
Yeah, I invited 15 landmark turntablists to come to Berlin for a few days and to play in this orchestra of turntables. The main motivation was that I found there's this worldwide community of turntablists who developed all of them, not the DJ kind of thing, practice, but really the experimental practice. They all have developed a very unique way of playing.
You mean each unique
each to each of
other?
Them sounds really different and does different stuff. They all sort of heard of each other. Like, it's like, I heard about you already. Like, so there was this kind of connection, even if they didn't know each other. They heard there's this guy in Berlin now who does this object thing. There's this guy there who just works with modified cartridges and blah, blah, blah. And I could fly in all these players from Japan, France. And the idea was that each of the players brought a simple composition or concept or graphic score. It was very intense. It was like a boot camp. I mean, but it was great. I mean, in the end, the orchestra really sounded like an orchestra, and you could really tell, you could really hear the character of each player, although it was the same instrument.
This is the International Turntable Orchestra, live at the Akademie der Kunst in Berlin in 2009.
The whole turntablism thing was, in music I wanted to be less dependent on the technological aspect of life or of society. Like, it's so present in, it defines people's lives now. They get up, the first thing is they do, they go to the computer to, or now even there's, I have the feeling there's no pause from, like,
from one screen to the next.
Yeah, it's like, yeah. And I noticed for me, like, I got a bit frustrated with this, and I wanted to not follow. And then I said, at least on stage, I want to be off screen. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Ignatz, thanks.
This has been the Noisy People Podcast, episode number 3. Special thanks for this episode go to my guest, Ignatz Schick, to Matt Ingalls and the members of SF Sound for bringing Ignatz to San Francisco and providing us with the opportunity to play together, to Roger Molina and Scott Gresham Lancaster of the University of Texas, and to Ty Noodle in Berkeley, California. And as always, to my audio guru, Philip Perkins, who isn't to blame for anything that's wrong with this show. I'm still doing it all myself. This podcast is now, or shortly will be, available through iTunes subscription, on SoundCloud, and at the website noisypeople.net, where you can also find images, outtakes, unedited versions of the interviews, and links to music and people referred to in the show. I'm also happy to announce our new association with Creative Disturbance, a podcasting project of Leonardo and the Art Science Lab of the University of Texas in Dallas. In addition to Noisy People, you can access their array of podcasts on various topics in art, science, and technology in both English and French at creativedisturbance.org. Noisy People is a project of Artifact Recordings, and this episode was produced in March 2015.